So I found the an airplane in Michigan that was in disrepair. It was needed an annual, and it was out of hydraulics, and the engine was in bad shape. And anyway, that was this engine that I didn't tell you about all that, Jim. But anyway, I took it in like a tired puppy, and we rebreathed it back to health. And after 10 years of working with it, had it just the way I wanted it, then we decided to we'd recover or restore an airplane that was found as pieces in a barn. It was an old Reno Air Racer that had been cast aside. And so that became the Gentleman Jim. And, of course, my friend Jay Whisker found the wrecked B model in Lake Louise in Florida, been in the water for 60 years or so, and 50 years or so. And so we built a new airplane around the pieces we got for that. So I was able to come back and leverage the resources we had in Roush Industries, which does a lot of things for automotive and for non-automotive and for military and actually some aerospace things today. Was able to use those resources to come back and find ways to make better parts and to rebuild the parts that that were still serviceable and to put them back in good shape. So it was my pleasure, my honor to be, as Jim said, the custodian of some really neat stuff and to help preserve, you know, the contribution that Bud made and all of his generation made to make America great once. We're working at making America great again, but it was certainly great in the World War II time frame, as everybody raised to the challenges that were presented at that time, and we're celebrating that.
In the video, you heard about the economy of this country beginning in 1942 and how it seemed to metamorphose just in a very short period of time, and what we did industrially to build everything. But Jim also mentioned about the fact that Bud never jumped out of an airplane, never crashed an airplane, and never aborted, all of those things. And that talks about the mechanical ability of the airplane not to break. Yeah. So how much was involved in those days of developing these airplanes to make sure that they would not break, and how big a challenge was that?
We could do a multiple day seminar on the airframe, and of course I've been a student of the airframe as well as the engine, but looking at the engine was certainly a marvel. It was resulted from the seaplane racing that Rolls-Royce did in the 30s, maybe the late 20s, in building competitive seaplane engines. And of course, when they realized that we got the Battle of Britain going in 39 and 40, and the English realized that they were going to need more engines, they went to the U.S. Industry, State Department, and asked if they'd help find a supplier. They initially approached Ford to build the Merlin engine, and Edsel Ford said that he would. And the Detroit News writer wrote something derogatory about Henry and said that he was changing his mind. He'd been a isolationist, and so he withdrew that. And so they had started making plans to tool up the Merlin, and they backed away from it. And, of course, it fell in probably the best technical hands for the job at the time, the Packard Motor Car Company, which was known for fine cars. Probably if you looked at the best cars in the world for quality and workmanship, you'd think of the Rolls-Royce maybe first, the Packard second. So Packard came back and had to come back and regenerate the Rolls factory in England had one lathe operator making one part, and so they weren't too careful about keeping their drawings right. So when Packard got the job, agreed to do the engine, do the manufacturing, they had to redo more than half the drawings because what the parts were that they were taking apart and looking at when they took away their demonstration engine was not what the drawing said they should have been. So they had to redesign the engine to the Rolls-Royce, what was being produced in the factory. Then they saw some opportunities. They changed that. And by the time they did the -3 engine, which was the first two-stage blower Spitfire-type engine that was capable of going to 42,000 feet, gave the engine, gave the Mustang legs so that Bud could fight him up and well up into the 30s. In fact, a number as I put my hands up like he did, a number of the fights he had that were vertical, you know, was successful because of the power the Mustang had and the reliability that it had. But as I've become a student of the engine and read everything I can get my hands on about Packard and the engine and things that happened, it becomes real clear the size of the job that they had and how seriously they took their responsibility. They ran every engine that they built. There were three variants that wound up in the Mustangs, the Dash 3, the Dash 7, the Dash 9. The blower ratios and a little bit of carburetor size and power increase was a few hundred horsepower only was the changes in it. They weren't great. But they, and from 1939 to 1956, there were 170,000 of these Merlin engines built. Packard Motor Car Company from 1943, late 1942 to 1945, about 85,000. The Packard engines were the best. Any part from any Dash engine would fit any other engine that was built. They were mass-produced along the lines of the way the automobile industry worked, which is not the way the English built their cars or their engines. So they were really great stuff. But and you look at the way the engines were built, they had 33,000 parts or something went into the engines. As I said, all the parts for all the Dash engines were the same. All the Dash numbers were the same. But just to give you an indication of how much work they went to, how much precision they put into their assembly part, they ran every engine before it went to war 11 hours in the factory. It ran for 6 hours on a break-in period. They tore it apart, looked at things that were critical. They put it back together. They ran it another 5 hours and put it in a box. I was telling David and the guys how many gallons of fuel they ran. They ran 80,000 gallons of fuel a day. That's 16,050 gallon drums of gasoline a day. For the entire period of the Packard was building the engines, which was basically the entire war. So they had 11 hours. They had 80,000 gallons of gasoline going through the factory a day. When Bud gets his engine and his line man got ready to change an engine, they didn't have to worry if it was going to be reliable. Because the other thing that Bud says, he had quartermasters behind him that were really showing preference to what he got and what he had worked with. One of the problems you had, all the lead in the fuel tended to clog up and contaminate spark plugs. The spark plugs would come out of an engine after a period of time, and they would go back into the depot, and they'd be cleaned, and they would go back in the engine. Bud's mechanics made sure that for every mission that he went on, that he had a brand new set of spark plugs, never been fired on before, never been cleaned. And the fact they took such care with his airframe and the maintenance of his engine, as well as what Packard was doing, speaks for the fact that he was able to survive the war without having to ditch an airplane and didn't have to jump out of one, didn't have to turn back from a mission.
Bud, how much of this information did you know when you transitioned from what, the P-39 to the P-51? How much of this information did you know, and how much confidence did you have in the airplanes that you flew in from day one in the Mustang?
I had no knowledge. It was really kind of weird. We trained in the P-39 Air Cobra fighters, and then we were supposed to retrain as a pilot, a replacement pilot, to go somewhere and fight the war. And when my turn came, they said, no, you're going to go over here and form a new fighter group and train another cycle, which was real important for me to get more time, flying time. And then we jumped in on a troop train and we're headed for New York. Yes. We wondered where we'd go, you know, Africa or South Pacific.
So they didn't tell you?
No. And we got somewhere between Casper, Wyoming, where we were training, and England. We learned that we're going to get this brand new P-51 Bravo with the Merlin engines. And we had not even seen a Mustang fly, let alone fly one. And so we had to go up to the place where they were assembling them.
In England?
In England. They brought them over and they were assembled, but not, you know, and got them going.
Right.
And then we'd send a guy up there to pick one up and bring it home and check out the next guy. And then we found out we didn't even have pilot flight manuals, you know. It was kind of strange. But,
so how many hours did you have in the airplane before you actually flew it in combat on a mission?
Well, in my case, I was probably the luckiest one in the fighter group. I had about 35 hours. When I got there, the group commander said, Bud, you're going to go to the Royal Air Force Central Gunnery School. And they had Spitfires. And he says, I want you to take a Mustang so you'll get more time that way. And so I took this brand new Mustang to the British field, and I got 35 hours in it.